This is the Who Wars Network. You have made the right choice.
Look out, this Rob and the team with the Who Wars podcast. The Alex and the Force, Blue Milk and Time Lords. It's the Who Wars podcast. It's the Who Wars podcast.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, episode number 36. You know, we are the audio fanzine for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. Now, before I kick on and talk about the week that's just been, I want to say one thing up front. In some ways, this is the biggest episode of Who Wars ever, and it's not in terms of its length. We've certainly done longer episodes. I mean, the one nudging 4 hours a few weeks back probably takes the cake. It's not to do with the number of people contributing, although we do have a number of contributors in this episode. It's not to do with an anniversary or any sort of metric like that, but simply because this is the first Who Wars episode with a bona fide doctor from Doctor Who talking to one of the team members on it. And this isn't a comedy skit. This isn't a rip-off. When you get to it, it's something other. No, this is a real doctor. It's the Sixth Doctor, Colin Baker, talking to Andy later in the show from his time at Hull Comic Con a couple of weekends back. I'm sure you remember, if you've heard episode 35, you've already heard a little about Hull Comic Con. And if you can just allow me to wax lyrical for a moment, when Who Wars began, interviews weren't really a big part of our format, largely because we didn't have enough team members to be chasing them up and doing them, you know, just knocking out a basic show with some reviews and some news and things of that nature was enough to get through each episode. That was back when we were doing a weekly episode too, by the way. And yet now, I can't think of Who Wars, an episode of Who Wars, without an interview or two in it. And we talk to all sorts of people. We talk to fans. We talk to people who write comic books or draw comic books. We talk to people who have written TV episodes. We talk to people who have written books about Star Wars. We talk to some novelists from Star Wars, and so on and so forth. People who have made fan documentaries. I mean, if you look at the interviews list on our website, it grows each and every week. And that's great. But, you know, up until now, we've never had a doctor on Who Wars, and today that record is broken. To me, the equivalent of having a doctor on in Star Wars terms is the equivalent of, say, one of the leads from the original trilogy, like a Mark Hamill or a Carrie Fisher or someone of that nature being on Who Wars. So make no mistake, this is a big deal. So we might not have fireworks going off, and it might not be a special episode number like a 25 or a 50 or something, but rest assured, this episode means a lot to me. And if I can just add one more thing before I go on, when you are listening to the Colin Baker audio, it's been taken from multiple sources, so the quality does go up and down. When you start listening to it, you might think, ooh, it's a little hard to listen to, particularly if you're not wearing headphones, perhaps. But just bear with it, because we then cut to a better sound source, and for most of the interview, it's quite good quality. When it gets to the Q&A from the audience, again, it comes from multiple sources, so it's a bit up and down there. But please stick with it. When you get to it, it does get better than what you initially hear. All right, elsewhere, what a week. I think it's unavoidable to mention that San Diego Comic-Con is happening as I speak, and you can't avoid it whether you're on Twitter or YouTube or Facebook or just talking to people you might know. Everyone's had a favourite moment from it so far. And I guess with regard to Star Wars and Doctor Who, both have had big announcements and big events over there. Doctor Who had a panel.
He loves travelling with Clara. I think that's the special bond he has is with Clara.
This is because we're going back to work on Monday. This is why.
Yeah. I've got to say that. But I think he'd like to see his granddaughter again.
There was the announcement of a Lego game, which frankly looks bonkers. It's got Batman and Gandalf teaming up with the Doctor, and you can play multiple incarnations of the Doctor. In fact, they had a William Hartnell Lego man bounding around, a beautifully rendered version of the first Doctor's TARDIS, right down to the fact that because they couldn't afford to make all the Roundels to fit the set, the Hartnell TARDIS used to have a picture of Roundels, like a photo wall, I guess you could call it, of Roundel pictures. Even that is incorporated into the design of this Lego TARDIS console room for the Hartnell Doctor if you're playing that particular version. It's amazing. And as I've said to people on Twitter several times this week, growing up in the 80s with the kind of Doctor Who merchandise we had then and the way Doctor Who was regarded then compared to now, it's just ridiculous. To those of you out there who've only known Doctor Who since 2005 and you've grown up in the modern era of pop culture, it must be astoundingly simple and straightforward that Doctor Who, of course, has a Lego game, and of course you can buy a lunchbox or a pair of underpants or a dressing gown based on Doctor Who. Of course. But to someone like myself, it's still ridiculous and bonkers and balmy and just... Am I dreaming this? I can't express it any other way than by saying it like that. It's just weird, but in a good way.
Come on, don't just sit there. You've got a bunch of monsters to meet.
Who are you? What did you do to us?
Is he always like this, Wildstyle? This is the TARDIS. It travels time. I've met you three before, but you haven't met me yet.
Can someone explain to me what's going on, please?
And, of course, also in relation to Doctor Who, there was a new trailer, but we're going to talk about that a little later in the show with some more team members and a few other folks who are going to become important in Who Wars over the months ahead, so stay tuned for that. And, of course, Star Wars had its big panel, sitting there today looking at Mark Hamill, sitting next to Carrie Fisher, sitting next to Harrison Ford, watching Harrison Ford kiss Carrie Fisher like it was 1980 all over again, and we were watching Empire Strikes Back. Just amazing.
Real sets. Practical effects.
You've been here, but you don't know this story.
Nothing's changed, really. I mean, everything's changed, but nothing's changed. That's the way you want it to be, really.
And, of course, people at San Diego Comic-Con have been snapping up copies of Dark Disciple by Christy Golden. That's a new novel based on some unfinished episodes of Star Wars Clone Wars. And we have a review of that book later on in the show. We've got Matt and Elaine, two people who have done a Star Wars review in the past for Who Wars. They've teamed up and they've done a joint review where they chat for almost half an hour about Dark Disciple. And it's not really spoilerific, so even if you've not read Dark Disciple, I encourage you to listen to that. I'm really happy with how Matt and Elaine work in that feature, and I hope they do many more for us in the future. And, of course, there was a big musical concert with fireworks and all sorts of stuff going on, featuring the Star Wars music of John Williams.
I'm hard at work on the new Star Wars score. I'm sorry I couldn't be with you this evening, but we've put together a few of my favorite musical moments to share with you, which I hope you enjoy. They'll be played tonight by one of my absolutely favorite orchestras, the San Diego Symphony. So we can help with you with a very, very talented Samir Patel. You fans have always been what's very special about Star Wars. And in December, all be joining together in a great, grand new adventure. Until then, have a great time tonight, and always may the Force be with you.
I was lucky enough to be on Twitter at the time, so people were using the Periscope app to sort of film the event as it was happening, and you could just click on a link and, watch live video coming from someone's mobile phone. that's mind-blowing as well when you think of, you know, the kind of technology we had in the 80s, you know, talking about the merchandise of the 80s a moment ago. The technology, too, it's just ridiculous that someone can hold up a little device and beam, you know, across the world to anyone with an internet-connected PC, instant pictures like that. It's just bonkers, but again, bonkers and crazy in a good way. I love that sort of stuff. But anyway, we aren't a news show, so I'm not trying to do a news overview here by any means. News is something that I think in time, when you look back at a podcast 6 months, 12 months later, is probably the least useful stuff. That's why we don't have a news section anymore. So anyway, I've completely blown out the intro this week. We try and keep these short, and generally we do, but this week it's just gone poof, and we have a long intro. Apologies for that, everyone, but I think you're going to really love what we've got coming up in this episode, The Dark Disciple. Review, Andy and Colin Baker at Comic Con, all sorts of fun stuff. So without any further ado, welcome to Who Wars episode number 36. Let's get on with the show. Okay, take 144.
Hello.
Hello, hello, hello. How are you doing?
I'm alright, long time no see.
Hi, this is J.R. Southall.
Hi guys, it's Elizabeth Gard here.
New Doctor Who content, yay!
And we're podcasting again, are we?
Apparently so.
Excellent.
Yay!
It's brilliant.
It's good.
Back. Together. I don't even know what it'll be like when it's edited together, but I'm certainly going to name drop that Dominic Clinton on Fringe.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Wow. Been happening?
I think, yes, there was a Doctor Who trailer on, Al.
That's right.
Rather
that's
sensibly
right.
This year, they put it on at Comic-Con, and like they did last year, but instead of us having to watch tatty little iPhone videos with people going, woo! Bits of it, we actually got it put properly on the telly this time, didn't we?
Yes.
So what do the Doctor Who review show, what's that? More later. What do the Doctor Who
Someone
review show team think of this trailer?
Pressing play on the trailer in 3, 2, 1, play. Some stars. Looks like 1980s. Oh, the TARDIS. Looks like the 1970s. Oh, oh, water. Oh, oh, flashing. Oh, oh.
That's exciting, isn't it? So when I first watched this, I was really impressed by all the weird, creepy aliens and the exotic planets. I'm happy to see that it's hopefully going to be a little less Earth-centric and a lot more of that space adventure feeling. So that should be awesome.
What made me go wow in the trailer? What made me go wow was the London Underground sci-fi futuristic set, which made me believe, are the Yetis making a comeback?
My wow moment had to be the music. That synthesized keyboard sound is quite stunning, and I hope it signals a change in direction for the series score overall, or at least for some of the episodes. It's a great change. It's very spooky. It's very sci-fi.
What excited me, bits that stuck out to me, we get an aerial shot of a city.
Yeah.
Which I'd like to think is a Dalek city that is very retro and very nicely designed, like some kind of, it almost looks like an old-fashioned model made out of plastic Christmas tree decorations. I like that.
The WTF moment for me is probably similar to other people, whether speaking here in this segment or out there in the wider world, and that's the Doctor rocking out with a guitar. I mean, we all know Peter Capaldi can play guitar.
Apart from the guitar, I liked it.
What was wrong with the guitar?
It just looks really... Must we? Do we have to do that? Don't consciously try and be cool. Although he does look cool, so... And the shades are good.
And then I went, wow... Like a real wow when I saw Capaldi on guitar and wearing sunglasses. You know, the Doctor has gotten cool.
But it's such an undoctorish sort of thing, you know, with the sunglasses and the guitar. I'm wondering if that's a Zygon version of the Doctor or something along those lines. That could be quite fun. If not, I'm very intrigued to know what it is.
Darkness. And I.
Yeah, oh, definitely. One thing that reminded me with that trailer specifically, because once I'd noticed it, I couldn't not see it. And when I tell you this, you might notice it now yourself, is that it reminded me a little bit of a theme that was running through Stephen Moffat's first series, you know, when Matt Smith came on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that very first series that he did, it was all about... Well, it wasn't all about, but there was an awful lot to do with vision, and that you weren't... What you saw wasn't what was there. And every single episode of the first series had something to do with eyes.
And speaking of eyes, how about those people with the creepy, dark-set eyes? Yeah, that is really creepy, and the episode is probably going to give me nightmares.
Darkness arriving. Oh, darkness. Oh, some things. Oh, a hand. Oh, no eyes. Oh.
I mean, God, how scary is that? That's going to have the kids hiding, isn't it? I like the way that Stephen Moffat always says, oh, yeah, I try to pick on real things that will scare the kids. You know, shadows, ticking clocks, noises, bumps, things that go bump in the night. I always try and find things like that that will scare the kids. Now we've got this guy walking along with his eye gouged out by spoons. Yeah, that's something you see every day in your bedroom, isn't it? You will now when you close your eyes.
Good for him. I think
the first wow was more of a whoa, was when the hand reached out of the mud. I got goosebumps then. That was just whoa, creepy.
Oh, darkness. Daleks! Oh, two faces. More darkness. A man. A woman.
Missy, what's up with the laser pointer on her mirror? Maybe it is just a laser pointer. I mean, it looks kind of like it might be somebody trying to shoot her, but maybe it's somebody just pointing a laser pointer, like playing with a cat or something.
Oh, there's the doctor. Oh, he looks a little knowing. And here we go.
I think I went WTF when I heard the line about kissing something evil to death. The doctor saying, I mean, I like that. That's kind of badass, but when would the doctor, like, ever say that? It's not really something he says. He doesn't kiss evil things, you know? He would never kiss a Dalek to death, right?
Overall, potential, but don't get too sucked into the hype, because we all remember Series 8's trailer, and where are we going? Into darkness! And the series didn't really reflect that at all. So, potential, but don't get too sucked in.
Overall, my reaction in one sentence to the trailer was a series that is unmissable.
Bigger, better, and with 20% more blue than last series.
Excellent! That's what I want!
I thought it was epic and exciting, and I can't wait for September.
September the 19th, eh? Who'd have guessed it?
It's coming back in September.
Yeah!
Late night. There's something about watching Doctor Who on a cold, dark winter's night. After you've had your beans on toast, you get some out of soup for your tea, and you sat watching it, and it's drizzling outside, you can hear the wind. There is something about watching Doctor Who on a night like that that just does it.
Hello, I'm Al, again, and I'm here with the him, who's about to see something and he hasn't got any idea what this is, so I'm just going to press play and get a reaction.
Do you want to watch it again?
Do you want to watch it again?
Let's watch it again.
Okay, right, so, are you excited about the new series of Doctor Who?
Sure.
What took you so long, the bit at the end, any idea who that might be or what that might be about?
I don't actually try and think into these things. I wait and see.
Okay. Does that make you more excited about the series?
What are you trying to do?
I'm trying to get answers out of you.
Honestly, what are you trying to do?
I'm trying to get your reactions to the trailer. Did you enjoy the trailer?
Sure.
Okay, right, great. And are you excited about the new series of Doctor Who now?
You've already asked me that.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not sure I'm getting an answer.
Yeah.
That's your answer, is it? Okay. Were there any bits in that that kind of... What about the guitar? Do you like the guitar?
Right. You know how when you hold down the camera button?
Uh-huh.
On, like, some of the later Apple products, and it takes, like, 24 photos a second? Right. Unlike you, I can't do that and save them all to my memory. And look at every single one individually.
Okay.
Right, because when you put on a trailer, I see you there just blinking your eyes repeatedly. Snap, 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 snap. Taking every single second in as 24 photos.
Uh-huh.
And then sifting through them all just like, yeah, what about that white Dalek? Yeah,
well,
what about that guitar?
In fairness, someone else pointed that out. The guitar I noticed because the guitar bit made me kind of go, Right, do you want to watch the Sherlock one?
No, I don't.
Okay. Okay, and on that bombshell...
Do you think Peter Capaldi's hair's got bigger?
Yes! That's my first comment! I don't know!
Go on! Say what you said in your notes about Peter Capaldi's hair.
And... I thought, blimey, that's a bit big. And I thought, oh, does he need a haircut? And then, he picked up that guitar. I thought, oh no, yeah. He's fine. He's fine with that haircut.
I think he looks like an eyebrowy town badger.
Oh, I love badgers! Yeah, I think someone's got an animal and my dad's a badger.
Peter Capaldi, it's like when they do Wind in the Willows plays, and instead of wearing a full badger mask, they just put a bit of a badger on an actor, like the hair or something. Do you know what the hair looks like? Who were that band? The Cartoons. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah.
Bing bang, walla
walla bing bang. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah.
Bing bang, walla walla bing bang.
What song is he performing with that guitar?
It looked very rock and roll. I was wondering whether it's a bit of a teaser and it was more like one big chord.
Power chord?
Yeah, a big power chord. And
like The Who?
Well, it's a bit like Marty McFly when he tries out the sound on Back to the Future and he ends up blasting backwards. I'm imagining something like that.
Yes, it could be. Is there anything else on your notes that you want to share?
Let me see. Scary, everything, haircut, the teaser at the end.
Oh, yeah, that was good, wasn't it?
Who
was she?
Who was that then?
Hey.
Who was that?
Oh, here comes Maisie.
Who is she?
Susan! With an exclamation mark.
Is she Susan regenerated?
It's the master as a child.
Or perhaps his daughter, Jenny.
I mean, is she, for example, Jenny?
That's funny. I've had a message saying, Romana!
They obviously know each other.
Who calls the doctor old man? And of course, I can't think of anybody, and it's driving me nuts.
Or is she just someone the doctor met earlier in the episode for the first time and you know, her calling him old man might just be literal. She sees him as an old man, not her old man, if that makes sense. Trailers are tricksy like that.
He deliberately puts things like this in so people will go, Susan, Romani,
exactly,
Romani,
exactly.
It's all a game.
He knows what he's
doing.
Yeah,
of course he does. He's playing the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and won't we look stupid now if it turns out to be Susan or Romana?
She's the meddling monk.
You.
What took you so long, old man?
She said when he saw her and he goes, you. It reminded me of Brian Blessed in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, because that's his only line.
Oh, yeah, he gets killed at the beginning, doesn't he?
Yeah.
What a waste of Brian Blessed.
I know, it's very upsetting. I think he said about four lines before that about going into battle, and then he just goes, you, and then dies.
Oh.
It reminded me of him. And that is my list.
That's brilliant. That was perfect.
Thanks.
I'm high-fiving myself. Yes. That works. Right. That's right. That goes into the format now. Excellent.
Oh, fantastic.
I'll tell you what, we'll just sew up. I'm going to edit this onto the end of it, Al. But all these exciting people who've been commenting on Doctor Who, wouldn't it be great if all these exciting people were commenting on the next series of Doctor Who on a more regular basis?
I think that would be absolutely fantastic. Is there any way that that could happen?
It's possible it could happen in a really tightly cut, exciting one-hour podcast, say. You know, with different people in different places and different ideas and different thoughts all coming together in different sections and putting across what they thought of a new episode of Doctor Who every week, maybe a couple of days after it had been broadcast. It would be good if that could happen.
It would be good if that could happen. Yes, I think that would be fantastic.
Well, why don't you all pop back, perhaps about the 23rd, 24th of September, and we'll see what we can do. Don't tell anyone. Shh.
That was great. Oh, that's brilliant. I like that. Oh, very good, very good, very good.
Classic Dalek. Who'd have guessed that?
Is that a classic Dalek?
Well, I don't know if it was a classic one. I think it was definitely a RTD Dalek.
No, behind it.
Hey guys, my name is Elaine Twight, and I am here with my good friend Matt. And
hello.
Yes, hello. Say hello. Yes, he's from, where are you from? Britain, right?
Yeah, England, Cambridge.
England. Oh, I love English accents. Anyway, so we are here on Who Wars to give you our thoughts on Star Wars Dark Disciple by Christy Golden, which is going to be released this Tuesday in America, in the United States, and it will be released on Thursday in the UK, right?
Yep, we sure will. Waiting for the postman on Thursday.
All right, so I guess we'll start off by just... We're gonna try not to give any big spoilers or anything, because we know that people need some time to read the book and digest it all. So we're just gonna start off by giving our general thoughts on it. So, Matt, what did you think?
Yeah, I think safe to say I loved it. It would be, and I know I said this for Lords of the Sith, but this is the best book in the new canon, in my opinion. I know you might love A New Dawn, but I just think for the story and for the way that it was written, because I thought the writing in it was superior to some of the others as well, but I just think the story and the consequences of it, without giving too much away, are huge. And I think because of that, it really highlights how good it was and also how big it is for the Star Wars universe. Overall, though, I read it in... like around 5 days, which for me, when I'm working a lot, is nothing. It's like, and I took as much time to read it as possible. But I was late coming back from lunch breaks. I was staying up far too late, like getting up late in the morning. So yeah, I absolutely loved it. What about you?
I loved it too, and I agree with you. I think it is the best of the new canon so far. I liked the writing style. I liked the pacing. As you said, this book has... more consequences than some of the other books in the past, like Lords of the Sith, Tarkin, Heir to the Jedi. None of those books really had any big effects, any big consequences on characters that we really care about. Whereas this book, you know, is much more impactful. And I actually finished it. I think I started it on a Wednesday or a Thursday, and I read like 11 chapters. And then on Friday night, I stayed up and finished it.
Wow.
So when I get really into a book, I usually just keep reading. But I've finished all the other books in about the same amount of time. So, but still, it was just so good. And I think that part of the reason... I mean, one of the things that I loved about it was its complexity. I mean, it had a level of complexity that I have not read in any of the Star Wars canon yet.
Yeah, I
just,
agree. Yeah.
Just like this, you're constantly, like, there are so many questions, like, how far, like, if you're going, if you have to go into the dark side to remove someone who is dark.
Yeah.
Like, this book centers around the idea that the Jedi are going to send someone to assassinate Count Dooku, and the question is, how far can you go? How far is too far, you know? And it's also about, like, how can you tell if someone is still in the dark side, you know? How can you tell? I mean, is there even a middle ground where where you can't tell? So I really like that complexity.
And you could say that you can easily, well, not easily hide, but it's been known for people to hide that the fact they're in the dark side, because, hey, you had the Emperor and they also had Senator Palpatine, and he was able to hide the fact that he was in the dark side for what seemed like years, and it was years, and there is a sense of that complexity. And you mentioned the pacing, and I think the pacing was something that was really, really key, because at the beginning of the book, I was thinking, oh, this is all so fun, the dialogue is full of jokes, it's all playful, everyone's getting along like an absolute house on fire. And then as it gets more deep into the dark side and this complexity comes up, the pacing slows down massively, and the interchanges between the characters are just much more shorter, and they're much more curt and cut, and a monotony appears, and you know, the Jedi Council talk to each other in a way that is just unknown. And I think we both agree that Mace Windu is definitely behind most of that. But
yes.
And she does a really, really good job. and at times I felt like I had to put the book down at times. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is heavy stuff. Whereas with the other books, I didn't get that emotionally invested. Like,
right. Yeah, I think this book in particular was very much writing on emotions. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it has been so popular among early reviewers, like you and me, is that there's so much emotion in this book.
Yeah.
And emotion, I mean, if something has emotion in it, that is usually, I think, what draws people in and makes people love it. Like, for example, like if Jurassic Park didn't have the element of being emotional about dinosaurs appearing for the first time in millions of years, I mean, it would have just been probably just a mindless monster movie. And not that those aren't good, but it wouldn't have gotten the same kind of love and nostalgia that it has now.
I mean,
we
still talk about Jurassic Park, as in, especially since like Jurassic World came out, and it's nowhere near as good as Jurassic Park. But you know, the fact that me and my colleagues still walk through the corridors, just singing the Jurassic Park like theme tune, it is a sense of that. And there is just emotion, whether that be emotion of love, or whether that be emotion of hate, or whether that be even confused emotion. It's just rippling through this book, and as a reader, you're like, oh, what's going to happen next? Where is this going to go? And that's fine. And I think it's safe to say, because it was in the blurb, like in the whole review of the book before it was even released, and it was released by Del Rey, that there is romance in it. But that isn't romance to say, oh, it's a bit like romance for romance's sake. No, I think the romance really, really creates, it's a central part of the book. And it is that part that is right down the middle. And yes, you have loads of repercussions, you have loads of consequences, and you have loads of side things, but it is this element of there are two people going through this thing, and that is what is central to the book. And it's two people that you care about.
Yeah, the romance worked really well as far as, you know, showing depth of character and showing the consequences of emotional attachment that is based very much on emotion and not much else. I mean, it is based on other things, but a lot of it is, you know, more like physical attraction and things like that. I mean, there is that aspect to it. So one of the things that I really liked about this book and was surprised by was how much Obi-Wan was present.
Yeah, loved it.
And yeah, I loved it too. I mean, he's my favorite character, and so when I first read the preview for Dark Disciple a few months mm-hmm. back, and I saw that, you know, the part of the first or second chapter was in his perspective, I was like, yay! And then yeah. I read the book, and we kept going back to his perspective. I'm like, yeah. yay! But I thought he really grounded things, and he really showed yeah. that through the events that happen, he shows how much he is the pretty much the best Jedi that they have, as yeah, far as being absolutely. A Jedi.
Yeah. I mean, he is the Jedi Code. Like, he just is. And the self-sacrifice that he's done in his life, and, you know, the ways that he tried to teach Anakin, mm-hmm. and tried, you know, tried so hard with Anakin, and unfortunately, you know, we all know what happened there. Spoiler warning, he's Darth Vader. but it's a sense of, I missed him. I've missed him in all the other books, and he just came in here, and he was just brilliant. He was wise. He was thoughtful about the things he said, mm-hmm. and he tried his best for both Ventress and Voss. I would say to make whatever their mission is or whatever happens into them work. And I think that's something that he can be really quite inspiring. And he's brilliant. He's just Obi-Wan and Star Wars 7 in the comics. It's just going to be amazing. So.
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah, I absolutely love the fact that he was here.
Yeah, I mean, I think John Jackson Miller wrote a standalone book about Kenobi called Kenobi.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's sad is that it was written like a year before Del Rey decided to start a whole new level of canon. So Kenobi was put into Legends.
Yeah.
And I wish that they would go and make a canon novel about, or a canon comic series about mm-hmm. Obi-Wan. I've seen, like, there are so many people who are clamoring for that kind of stuff, and for a Obi-Wan Kenobi spinoff movie. I'm like, yes, yes, forget Boba Fett, just do it. So, it, like you said, it was really great to see him here, and I really liked the humor
mm-hmm.
that he and some of the other characters brought. I mean, it was really funny. It was very... I haven't seen many episodes of The Clone Wars, but this book felt like... I mean, obviously, it was based off of unfinished Clone Wars yeah. scripts. So, of course, it's going to feel like The Clone Wars, but still, you know, that aesthetic could have been lost in the writing of a novel, but it wasn't. And I thought that was part of the reason why the pace was so,
I agree.
Was so quick, was because it was based off of Clone Wars.
And I think I wrote something like Ventress and Anakin and Obi-Wan. They actually run off each other very well, like in the way they speak to each other, and they're very much frenemies, if you know what I mean. So they're mm-hmm. you know, friendly enemies where they've met each other on either side of the lightsaber, and sometimes they have to wield them together. And it's, you know, and you obviously have that moment at the end of Clone Wars with Ahsoka and. And Ventress, and you know, they know each other very well,
mm-hmm.
And they stick together very well. And yeah, it was just really good fun at times. Sometimes it was a hard read, and that wasn't because it was poorly written. It was just hard read because you just saw people going through anguish, and mm-hmm. I don't think that's too strong a word, because you just saw people go through, you know, alcoholism nearly, and people doing things for the sake of others that they would never have done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's saying too much at all. What did you think of the procession of loved characters, like, you know, the bounty hunters that turn up and things like that? What did you think of that?
I thought that the whole bounty hunters was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it worked pretty well. I think that if it had been made into an actual episode, I think we would have seen a lot more of them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that was a good move, and
because when they initially turned up, I was thinking, oh, are they just putting them in because they know it'll please some fans, or are they just putting them in because it makes part of the story better? And I think it actually made part of the story better. It wasn't just a let's put some famous names in. And then some people would just be happy. I didn't think it was that.
Right. I mean, and you get the feeling that they kind of have their own story going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Behind it, but it doesn't take over the other stuff. Like I think I thought at first that it was going to, like, we were going to see something from Boba's perspective or something.
Yeah.
Because there was a clip of a story reel or some of a story reel of one of these episodes where the bounty hunters are fighting Count Dooku.
Oh yeah.
And so I thought, well, this is going to be the, but it was you see the aftermath of that.
Yeah. Did you think because it was, I think it was 8 episodes, wasn't it, of the Clone Wars into this book?
Yes.
Did you find it episodic at all? Like, I was trying to play the game of, right, this is probably where an episode ended, or this is where an episode, and I just failed miserably. I thought it did actually quite flow nicely, even though it was meant to be, you know, eight episodes, just this is episode one and this is episode two. And I thought Christy Golden did a really good job of, you know, unifying those.
I agree. I mean there is a sense of separation in that. In that the story moves from place to place.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
Depending upon, like, what, because, like, the story is made up of, like, small arcs, small mm-hmm. character arcs, small story arcs. So if you keep track of that, you could probably kind of decipher, probably discern where the episodes would have begun and ended.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's part of any book almost. Is that you have, sometimes you have the characters go on a journey and you have, you know, they start out here and they end up here, and it, you know, a lot of things happen in between, and that's just normal for a story.
Yeah.
But, you know, did you find yourself wishing that they had spent a little more time had been spent in certain scenes, like that it hadn't run quite so quickly through it?
Yeah, I think the initial meeting between Ventress and Voss was quite rushed, and how quickly those two came together mm-hmm. was like, whoa, that happened quickly. And I think possibly at the ball that they go to, and how they find the quarry, as it were, I think that could have been a little bit slower, because it just seems like, oh, they jumped there very quickly. But again, I think that's because she had a lot to fit in.
That's true.
And I think I'll look it up now, but I'm not sure how many pages it is actually in print.
I think it's about 400 something. Yeah.
It's going to be, bear with me, it is, yeah, 336 on hardcover. So in paperback, that'll be going on 400. So, yeah, it is, it's probably one of the biggest canon books so far, I would say. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, she has she has 8 episodes to fit.
Exactly.
Into one story. And each episode is, I mean, if it had been aired on TV, it would have been about 22 minutes long each, so yep. That's almost a half hour.
Exactly. So I think she did really well, but yeah, I agree. If they, it could have been even more grounded, and that would have been even more awesome. But saying that, I think she did a great job, and I'd love to see her write some more, and maybe write some more that she hasn't got, like, scripts in front of her, where she's got full, you know, creative freedom to go absolutely mental, to spend what she wants, because she writes something that has been put in front of her so well. I'd love to see what Christy can do with something that she's got kind of a free palette and a free like canvas to go exactly where she wants to go, because I think I would trust her with my most loved characters, and you know, whether she writes, you know, a spin-off story about Hera, I mean, how amazing would that be? That'd be awesome. And you know, and I think I'd welcome that, whereas I wouldn't be able to say that about all the authors in the canon so far, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that Christy Golden has written several books, several Star Wars books.
Yeah.
But I never read them because they were part of these huge series, and I didn't want to read all those books.
Yeah.
Because I thought, if I start on this series is 9 books long.
Yep.
How long it's going to be before I can read something else.
Exactly, yeah.
So, but I know she has written books before, but this is the first one that I've ever read. And I was very pleased with it. I liked the straightforward, the directness of the prose, and it wasn't too frilly or too elaborate as far as, you know, it wasn't really, really descriptive. And I just, I do wish that a little more time had been spent in certain areas.
Yeah.
But I can see why she didn't, because like we said, she has so much to fit in 300 to 400 pages.
Yeah. What did you think of the Jedi Council? Because they are quite prominent in this book, you could say, because they have to be.
Well, I was very surprised, honestly, by the way some of them acted. And by what their opinions were. But it really went to show how Obi-Wan and Yoda are the best Jedi there. I mean, the definition of a Jedi, those two. I mean, Yoda kind of, you know, he appears to agree with some things that he probably shouldn't, but I think that most of that is just trying to compromise.
Yeah.
You know, because he's the leader and he's trying to keep peace within his own group.
Yeah.
And but Obi-Wan especially really comes across as being almost the only one who is like, we shouldn't be sending someone out to kill Count Dooku.
Yeah.
We should not do this. And he makes some wonderful speeches that I just want to hug him for. I'm like, oh.
And I think, and then, but who is it at the end who is in the middle of it all? It's Obi-Wan. And I don't think that's giving a spoiler at all. It's kind of to be expected. And it's, even though he might not agree with everything that's gone on, he's still there helping the consequences.
Being supportive.
And at the end, he is the man who stands, I would say, the tallest out of the whole of the Jedi Council. Mm-hmm. Because he's done everything he can, and yeah, it's something I wasn't expecting to see in the book, because the preview is all about, you know, Voss and Ventress and Count Dooku, and then at the end of it, the real hero, you could say, is Obi-Wan, and that's no bad thing in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it. I definitely wasn't expecting him to have such a big presence, and he did. He was like the third main character outside of Ventress and Voss. Did you think that, speaking of Ventress and Voss, did you think that Ventress had too little? I mean, are you satisfied with how much we got to see of her as opposed to how much we got to see of Voss? I mean, do you think it was well balanced, or?
I think that's pretty well balanced. I think the reasoning Voss may have got more is because we barely saw him in Clone Wars. Like, we saw him in a small arc, where Ventress, if you watch the whole of Clone Wars, she's everywhere. She is pretty much everywhere. And so, I guess, you know, the readers of Dark Disciple, I guess, will know of her a little bit more than they might know of Voss, because in canon, as it is now, he's only in Clone Wars. Yeah, I kind of see your point, but I was quite happy with the amount we got of Ventress. What about yourself? Did you want more of her?
I was pretty satisfied with it. I mean, I feel like maybe through the first half or two-thirds of the book, a lot of it is Quinlan. But I don't know. It's kind of balanced between Obi-Wan, Ventress, and Voss.
Yeah.
And I think Voss has the most scenes. I'm not sure about the other two. They might be kind of equal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
But, I mean, Ventress, I think you could argue that Vos goes through a bigger change than she does.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense to have it have a lot of the story told through his perspective, because a lot of it is his story.
Yeah.
And then as far as Obi-Wan goes, he kind of has a more of an impartial view of how things are going. I mean, he has a stake in it, obviously, but he's not emotional like Vos and Ventress are. And so he provides kind of a nice ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
For you to view everything else that's going on. And Ventress had some really nice moments.
Yeah.
And obviously she's present in most, even if a lot of the story isn't told through her perspective, she is present.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was really key.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to see, and when it was from her perspective, you got to see the perspective of someone who had completely fallen into the dark side and come back and has been tempted by it again. And that was something that I'd never really seen before. And I thought that was really quite an exciting point of view that she could bring across to the Jedi Council, to Boss, to Obi-Wan, and say, hey, I've been there, you know, and this is how I did it and how I defeated it, and this is how I turned my back on it. And I was like, whoa, well, I've never really, you know, because we always think, oh, when you go to the dark side, you become like Vader. And she was like, well, not really. Necessarily. Yeah. So all in all, I think we both agreed that you should read this book.
Oh, absolutely.
How many stars would you give it out of 5, for example?
I always have trouble with these.
Yeah, I know. Likewise. That's why I asked you first.
4 or 5.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean,
I was going to go 4.5. I would generally say I enjoyed it that much.
Yeah. And I mean, if I were to give it, like, a number between 1 and 10,
yeah,
I would probably give it a 9.
Wow. I see. I'd go 8. But that's still pretty good. Oh, let's be honest, you know.
Yeah.
If you get an 8 out of 10 in most things, you can be pretty happy.
Yeah. I mean, I rate books, and then I think later, I wish I had done something else.
Yeah.
But anyway. Yeah. So you can, like I said, you can pick it up in the U.S. on Tuesday and in the U.K. on Thursday.
Yep.
We don't know when it will become available in Australia, though.
Sorry, Rob.
But you can get it on digital or hardback.
Yeah, it's hardback first, and then paperback will be released around 6 months' time, I imagine.
Right, I know, that stinks.
Yeah. But,
anyway, so thank you for listening. If you'd like to, if after you've read it, you would like to talk to us about it, you can find, where can they find you, Matt?
I am known as the SW Canon Rebel, so because on the rebellion of people who loved canon and not legends. So, SW Canon Rebel. And where can we find you? Oh, that's Twitter. Yeah, and I also have a blog, so that's on my Twitter as well, so you'll be on that. And where can we find you, Elaine?
You can find me on Twitter at TVEITLIGHT25.
Cool.
I wish mine were as simple as his, but it's not so. So thanks for listening. We really enjoyed talking about this, I think. And,
yeah.
So we look forward to the next book.
Exactly. Aftermath in September. Oh my gosh. How exciting.
So, okay. Thanks, guys. See you later.
Bye.
Brace yourselves, listeners, for a segment 7 years in the making. Right now. And for many episodes to come. Rob is watching the Clone Wars.
Yes, indeed. Hello, folks. I'm back again to talk about Star Wars Clone Wars. And I have to say, during this past fortnight, I've been a bad Star Wars Clone Wars fan. Probably for two main reasons. One being, I've been quite busy in my real life. I've mentioned how at work I've been covering for a colleague who's been overseas on holiday and so on. And I won't go on about that. You don't want to hear about my real life stuff. Also, in addition to that, I've known for a little while now that I'm coming up to the Season 1 stories that kicked off Clone Wars. I mean, yes, we've been reviewing Clone Wars for all these weeks in chronological order, but here we actually get to Season 1, Episode 1, Ambush. It originally aired in the US on October 3rd, 2008 and was watched by almost 4 million people. And I watched Clone Wars in the early days of the series. I've said that before, as some of you might remember. And so I remember these episodes to some degree, and I didn't particularly want to go back. So between being very busy and not wanting to really watch these episodes, even though I know I have to push through and get through, for the purposes of these chronological reviews I'm doing, to get through to the good stuff, as it were, I know I have to look at them, but this episode, I'm just looking at Ambush. For those of you who haven't seen it, maybe since it originally aired, this is the one where Yoda and a trio of clone troopers have to face off against Asajj Ventress and a big droid army to prove that the Jedi are the ones who are strong enough to protect a strategic planet and forge a treaty for the Republic with the king of this planet. And, yeah, you probably remember it. It's got a lot of Yoda jumping about and being quite wild in it. So, without any further ado, what did I think of it? Well, I found the premise a little weird. The king of this planet has essentially decided he'd like to go with the Republic, and Yoda's coming along to forge this treaty, and that's fine. But then Asajj Ventress turns up and says, oh, look, we've got more droids. We can do this, that, and the other for you. She pulls out a little holo projector, and Count Dooku has a chat with this king. And it seems quite weird, because it's fairly obvious the king wants to go with the Jedi, but then he agrees to this concept that, oh, look, Yoda's come down to the planet with these three clone troopers. Yeah, sure, Asajj, why don't you take your army of droids and fight them, and whoever wins, I will sign the treaty with them. It just seemed so fake, because I think he, as I say, he decided to go with the Jedi. If they had managed to kill Yoda and these three clones, would he have been happy going with the Separatists? I don't think he would have. And with that whole storyline permeating these 22 minutes or however long it is, it kind of left a funny taste in my mouth about the episode. I mean, sure, it's great to see these clones fighting the droids, and it's fun to see Yoda jumping around and using his lightsaber, and, you know, there's some classic moments in it. In fact, they seem to have modelled this Yoda in this episode on the Empire Strikes Back Yoda, where he's being quite eccentric and, you know, chuckling and such with Luke Skywalker, and here that's kind of replicated with this Yoda. In fact, there's a scene where he and the clones go into a cave to have a little bit of a rest from this battle. And because the cave has a very low ceiling, everyone's sort of hunched over, and it's very much like Yoda's hut on Dagobah, and I'm sure that's not a coincidence. So just as, you know, more recent episodes of Star Wars Rebels, people go, oh, that's like that moment in A New Hope, and oh, that's like, you know, that moment, blah, blah, blah. Even here in Clone Wars, you can see them, you know, copying stuff from the original trilogy, and that was very much an Empire Strikes Back moment for me. But I digress. Of course, Yoda and the clones win the day, and the king decides to sign up with them. Not that I think it was ever in doubt, as I was saying earlier, and Asajj Ventress, you know, runs off into a ship like, you know, a comedy sort of villain from, I don't know, the Wacky Races cartoon or something, and blasts off in her ship. It's all, you know, a bit light, and I can see now, having watched it again, why, when this was the only episode of Clone Wars I'd ever seen, of the TV version, at least, of course, there'd been the movie before this, I was underwhelmed, because I'm still underwhelmed to some degree, although not as underwhelmed as I was at the time. As I've said in past reviews, I think watching Clone Wars now, in the fullness of time, and knowing things that I didn't know then, I'm not as averse to these episodes as I thought I'd be, so I think I'll be able to get through the next season without too much trouble. I think I was worrying over nothing. Overall, it's probably about a 6 out of 10, a 7 out of 10. It's nothing special. The plot's a bit strange. The action is fun, though, and it's an interesting little side mission for Yoda and some clones. That's essentially all it is. In some ways, it's a strange way to start the series. After you have that movie, I think watching it chronologically has been quite a good thing. To watch a number of very exciting episodes, and then the movie, and then some more episodes, and now onto this, rather than sort of kicking the series off with this, because this wasn't that amazing, I've got to say. Oh, and before I go, I've mentioned in the past the guy who does the Obi-Wan Kenobi voice acting, and how he says some words in a very non-English, non-British kind of way, but I'm sure ears in the US don't really pick up on it. And here again, where we've got the clones and they're doing that sort of semi-Kiwi accent, which again, Australians are very attuned to. I mean, half of New Zealand seems to live at Bondi Beach here in Australia, but I digress. We're very used to the Kiwi accent. And so when one of the clones says, blah, 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 Master Yoda, I'm thinking, Master Yoda? What? A Kiwi would not say Master Yoda. He would say Master Yoda. Master, Master, Master. Let me say it a million times. Not Master Yoda. So you have this weird sort of semi-Kiwi accent that's hitting its beats pretty well. But then it gets to Master Yoda and it's like, oh no, my ears, my ears. But again, ears in the US might not be as attuned to this. You might not, you know, really talk to many Kiwis in your day-to-day life and not just pick up on the way the accent works. So again, little things like that stand out to me too, but that's small fry stuff. That's nothing to worry about. That's just me being amused by, you know, folks who do voice acting, and they get so much of it right, but then they get some real clangers wrong as well. Anyway, let's end on that. This is a 6 out of 10, a 7 out of 10. Let's settle on 7 out of 10. I'm feeling generous this weekend. 7 out of 10 for Season 1, Episode 1, Ambush, written by Stephen Melching and directed by Dave Bullock. What did you think? If you can remember this episode, or if you've watched it recently, why not write in and tell me at hello@whowars.net, or even pull out your microphone, pull out your headset that you use to game with, and just record yourself for a minute or so telling me what you think, and send it to the same address, hello@whowars.net, and we'll use it on the show. Cheers, guys.
Hey, people. I've got your Titan Comics Doctor Who 10th Doctor number 12 issue coming up for you. All right, so this issue, we've got the awesome cover by Kevin Wada, who we heard from on the Phoenix Comic Con special. Hi, Kevin. I love his style. It's angular but soft with the watercolors, and I actually would love to see a whole issue of just his work. That would be awesome. There's a variant. It's got Tennant with kind of like the city in the background and a mysterious pentagon silhouette in the sky. So our writer here is Nick Abadzis, artist Elena Casagrande and Eleonora Carlini. So it's two artists. I'll talk about that more later. And then the colorist, Ariana Florian. So last time we were left with the major cliffhanger of the 10th Doctor's retro regeneration into the 9th Doctor. And this literally gets resolved in like the first four pages of this issue. So that was kind of disappointing if you ask me. So we find out that the actress isn't quite as vain as we thought she was. She actually has a terminal illness, and that's why they wanted the artifact, was to try to slow the process with that. We also see Cleo reporting back to her mysterious organization, and we find out some interesting tidbits. Like, they've heard of the Doctor, they're familiar with Torchwood, they're apparently familiar with Cleo's mom. So then we come to find that Dorothy, the actress, has connected with the power source of the artifact, and the two eventually merge to what the Doctor calls a rejuvenation and something more, and she says she's glowing with youth. And then also sprinkled throughout this issue, we also see this spaceship in outer space. And there's only this narrative that keeps going across there. And so we end with the cliffhanger, just these words. It says, I am awake. It is time. Now that I have heard you, I will answer. To Soul 3, to Earth. And then it says, to be continued. So what did I think of this issue? Well, much like the last issue, I did feel like it was still kind of hard to follow. But I feel like it's getting a little better. So, like I said before, there was two artists. I thought that was different. I hadn't really noticed that before. I think the two artists' styles are similar enough that they meshed well together. But I would still prefer just one artist for continuity. And then on page 23, I don't know what's up with that. There's this noticeably different style for the friend Cindy than all the others. And it just didn't really make sense to me. I don't know what was happening with that. Very bizarre. So overall, I feel like this issue is starting to pick up more, especially more than the last issue. but they really missed such a big opportunity with the retro regeneration thing. I think they should have had him be the Ninth Doctor for more than just four pages. There's some really interesting stuff they could have got into with that, but instead it's just like, nope, everything's back to normal. So I wasn't the biggest fan of that. I do think the next issue will be even better than both of these, so I'm excited for that. Overall, let's give this one 7 Sonic Screwdrivers out of 10. And yeah, looking forward to more to come with the Doctor and Gabby. And even Cindy, I guess. She was a little less annoying in this one. Hopefully she'll get even less annoying as we go on. Alright, that's it for this review. L11Z, and may the Force be with you.
Hello, I have a review for you of the 14th issue of the 11th Doctor. This one's called The Comfort of the Good, Part 1. And it's written by Al Ewing and Rob Williams. And the artist is Simon Fraser. So overall, I liked this story a lot. I did. It has a great surprise at the end. And there's beautiful artwork that it's not just pretty, but it conveys emotion really well, I thought. Like, the colors are kind of gray, and they match the emotion of the Doctor who's just lost his TARDIS. The Doctor has been a very naughty boy. He's been doing things like creating paradoxes to save his friends. Normally, the TARDIS is okay with kind of that kind of thing. But I guess he's really crossed the line on this one. The TARDIS has had enough. There's actually this really funny part where I guess it's kind of funny. I don't know. I thought it was funny and very clever of the artist to do this, or whoever it was that decided that this should be done. The TARDIS and the Doctor have a stare down. So, you know, those intense moments in movies you get sometime of the two opposing characters. For each line that they give, maybe they'll have like a close-up, so they get closer and closer and closer into their eyes, and it's really intense. They do that with the Doctor and the TARDIS, and the TARDIS doesn't even have eyes, yet they manage to have a stare down together. I thought that was really clever. The plot line I'm not crazy about, I guess, and it was a little bit too dramatic. That's why I say I wasn't crazy about the plot. I mean, it was a little too heavily focused on the emotion of the Doctor and trying to get the reader to feel for him, which really isn't a difficult thing for a fan of Doctor Who to do. So I thought that was unnecessary. Well, all right, to specifically explain what I mean, they have these narrative boxes at the end, and they're really disjointed in thought. Like, they start off with a really general statement, maybe for background for those who just happen to jump into reading the comic. Okay, I get that. But it's super obvious to those who are already following the comic. And it's about Serview Inc. and how they give people what they want to get more power. And that's it. They just say that. And then they talk about the Doctor's feelings. There was no conclusion about why they were bringing that up. It was just like, oh, hey, yes, Serview Inc. gets power by giving people what they want. Okay, so what? But that wasn't the worst part. So from there, they talk about the Doctor's feelings about losing the TARDIS. And they apply this metaphor of saying it was like a breakup. It's really obvious what they state. They say how the TARDIS decided he was unworthy. We get that. We just read the whole comic story. You know, we were there a few seconds ago. We know that. So they state that obvious part. And then they actually tell the reader to remember, and this is a quote, the worst breakup you ever had. Okay, so firstly, this type of writing I might expect in a child's comic. I suppose, you know, with this kind of disjointed, inconclusive thought pattern, because they can't really tell the difference. They just want the kind of the high intensity drama and the excitement, right? So, okay, it's for a child's comic. Fine, but we're not old kids and we don't really like disjointed thought patterns, right? Okay. Secondly, it was unnecessary to get the readers to feel sympathy for the Doctor, and I've already said this. fans of Doctor Who, we're big on the sympathy, all right? And we don't need to be told to specifically remember something and apply it to that situation, because we're going to do that already. It was so blunt and kind of patronizing to the reader. I mean, come on, you can trust us enough as readers to feel sympathy for the Doctor losing his TARDIS. Ugh, you don't have to tell us to feel sorry for him. Third, they never even had a conclusion on that train of thought about the breakups. You know, like, that is just great. Thanks a lot. You make me imagine the worst breakup I've ever had for nothing. And they didn't even offer a comforting thought. Not even a piece of advice. It was just, you know, remember this, think of this. And they just kind of left us. I mean, why are they even talking about breakups if this sort of heavy drama or is meant for kids, you know? Kids, what do they know about breakups? Maybe one of the members of the comics team had a really tough breakup recently. Maybe that's what this is about, and it's like a secret message to one of their co-workers. That would be nice. I hope that's the case. My condolences to all you people out there who have recently had a breakup. They suck. And I'm sorry for just reminding you of it. And no, I don't have any advice for you either. Alright, so... Was that blunt? I'm sorry. Really, I am sorry. But apart from that long tangent I just gave about the narrative boxes, I really did like this issue. I especially liked how this comic began. It has Jones welcoming the reader to his little memory attic. It was sad because, well, he's dead. But it was still ridiculously cheesy, as most of Jones's lines are. So him saying, "I wanted to be someone special, someone like nobody ever before. I wanted to be one of the stars, ... I'm dead now." That was great. It was so, I don't know, blunt, I guess. I'm using that word a lot today. But it was funny. I was laughing. I guess I knew he wouldn't just be that easily killed off, so I was mainly concentrating on the humorous parts. I love Jones. I hope he never dies. There is so much fantastic art in this issue. Simon Fraser did a really amazing job, I think. We get to see Jones flying in the stars. There's this one square in particular that I really, really liked. Simon Fraser did such a good job, really. There's this part where Alice hugs the Doctor to comfort him, losing his TARDIS. He's all, you know, broken down, hunched over. I just love the angles that he chose to show their pained expressions and their posture. I don't know, it just really captured the emotion really well. There's this one slide in particular that's so beautiful. Like, there's these thick lines of pastel in the sky. It's like a turquoise gray. It's not something that represents like reality as it is. It's very sort of abstract, but God, I would love a poster of that one particular image. It's very simple. It's just one bubble of the Doctor saying a simple thank you. Yeah, I don't know. It was so pretty. I want a poster of that. So yeah, it was kind of an intense issue. Not too funny, although Jones has its moments, and that stare down I thought was pretty clever. And then there's this really big surprise at the end, which I won't give away. It is a good lead-in to the next story. So Ark saves the day for the 1,000th time. He gets Jones back, and he leads the Doctor to his TARDIS. They chose to give Jones a look that is just like the aliens shown in the Man Who Fell to Earth movie. So they're still giving reference to David Bowie stuff, which I liked. I appreciated that. And as I said, big surprise at the end. Their spaceship, or the Entity and Ark combined ship, lands in the middle of a big public park in London. Lots of people see it. It's pretty funny, and we see a certain Time Lord that the TARDIS is led to. So that's exciting. And I'm leaving off here. So Yeah, basically, I like this issue a lot. I had a little bit of an issue with, well, actually a big issue with those narrative boxes that were inconclusive and disjointed and overly dramatic. But hey, it's a comic. We like intense emotions sometimes that are absurd. So, yeah, all done. Talk to you guys later. Bye.
What's that flare? You see it? A green flare coming from Mars. Kind of a green mist behind it. It's getting closer. You see it, Bermuda? Come in, Bermuda. Houston, come in. What's going on? Tracking station 43, Canberra. Come in, Canberra. Tracking station 63. Can you hear me, Madrid? Can anybody hear me? Come in. Come in.
Hello, that was the epilogue from Jeff Wynne's musical version of War of the Worlds. Why, you may ask? Well, it's because the script was written by Jeff's mum, Doreen, who came from the city of Hull. So that's a sci-fi connection to the city, which is great because this is a treat for you lot from Hull Comic Con.
Excuse me, where am I? I was in London. I was in the middle of London.
You're in Hull.
No, I'm not.
This is Hull.
No, it isn't.
You're in Hull.
I'm not in Hull. Stop saying Hull.
Don't have that in London. There's no call for it. It's all Hull.
So, over the last couple of programmes, you've heard how my home city is to be the UK City of Culture in 2017. A lot of events are starting to take place and build up to that. Hull Comic Con being one of them, and I was really excited to be asked by District 14 Events that organised it to host the Q&A sessions. I turned out to be a lot busier than I expected, in a good way, because I was having great fun hobnobbing with the stars and being in a position of linking the audience with the guests. All still a bit mind-blowing to me, I'm afraid. Anyway, I did have a moment to pop outside into the sunshine, and amongst the 2,500 attendees, I spoke to some Doctor Who cosplayers.
Right, I've just nipped outside and I've bumped into some fascinating-looking familiar people. I'm here with the Seventh Doctor, I think.
Hello.
Hello. You're not Sylvester McCoy, are you?
No.
What's your name, sir?
Derek.
And Derek, why are you dressed as the Seventh Doctor today?
Because he's my favourite Doctor.
Is he your favourite?
He's my
favourite.
Fantastic.
And what's your favourite Sylvester McCoy story?
Delta and the Bannerman.
Delta and the Bannerman, excellent. Costume is fantastic. You've got the umbrella.
Yeah, bought that.
Bought that. You've got the question mark jumper.
Yeah, I just got that.
It looks fantastic. And the whole ensemble looks absolutely amazing.
Oh, brilliant.
Are you looking forward to meeting the Sixth Doctor today, though?
I am, because he's my other favourite.
Oh, you're the first. So you're absolutely going to have a great day today. Well, I hope you enjoy yourself.
Thank you.
And now I've got also got here. You look like a very young Tom Baker, sir.
Hello. Hello. Would you like a jelly, baby?
What's your name, sir?
Robert.
Robert, and you've decided to come adorned with a Tom Baker scarf today.
I am the president of the university's Doctor Who Society.
Are you really?
Yeah.
What a fantastic...
I'm vice president.
Right, would you like to promote the university Doctor Who Society,
if
please?
You don't mind.
Go for it.
We've got, lots and lots of stuff coming with September. We've got... What have we got, Dave?
Come on, Dave. What have we got?
We've just launched our new Twitter page at huudocsoc.
Excellent. Nice chatting to you. Did I see a 10th Doctor lurking around somewhere?
Yes.
Hello, 10th Doctor.
Hi.
Now, what's your name?
Melissa.
And are you one of these tenant fangirls that we hear about?
Of course I am.
And And do you miss him still? Are you still watching Doctor Who?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And do you still enjoy it?
Yes. It was really good when he came back in the Day of the Doctor.
Yes.
But, you know, it wasn't quite the same, you know.
No, it's not quite the same. But no. was he your first Doctor? Do you remember it when it came back with Christopher Eccleston on?
Yeah, Chris was my first Doctor, but yeah. David's my Doctor.
He's your Doctor.
Yes.
Are you entering the cosplay competition?
Most probably, yes.
Fantastic. And are you excited about meeting one of the older Doctors today?
Yeah,
Colin Baker.
Colin Baker, yeah.
Have you met him before? Have you met any of the Doctors before?
I have, yes. Four times.
Four times?
Yeah.
Right, so he might recognise you. I'm a bit the same. I'm running out of things for him to sign. But yeah. Well, I hope you have a really fantastic day.
Thank you.
And I'll see you later. This is going to be on the Who Wars podcast, so do look it up on Facebook.
Yeah,
okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Are you a Doctor Who fan by any chance?
Yes.
What's your name?
Heather Coe.
And have you been to any of these sort of conventions before? Is this your first one?
I'm a newbie.
Have you ever seen any of them on telly or read about them?
No, about them.
Right, because they're rather exciting events.
This is my first Doctor Who to talk to and get.
So you're going
to
meet Colin Baker?
For the very first time.
Fantastic. I'm sure he'll look after you. He's a very nice chap.
I've heard he's very
friendly. Oh, he's very nice, yes. I hope you have a fantastic day as well. Hello, War Doctor.
Hello.
How are you? I'm reporting for the Who Wars podcast here.
Ah, yes.
Now, so when did you decide to start becoming the War Doctor?
When I saw David the Doctor.
And you enjoyed you liked the look of that Doctor? Oh, the first Doctor you've ever cosplayed as, or were you a...
The first cosplay search I've ever done.
Right. I've seen you before at events, and you're very striking. Do you find that a lot of people are coming up to you for photographs?
Oh, yes.
How does that feel?
Flattering. Oh yes, I know I've got it right.
Excellent.
Thing is, I've got to do a costume that fits the beard.
Absolutely, yeah, build it around the beard. Mm. And what's your name, sir?
It's Brian Dale.
Brian Dale, right. Well, listen out for us on the Who Wars podcast. There'll be links on the Facebook page, and thank you very much for having a chat. It is the War Doctor. You shouldn't know he's yet. there's a bit of a time conflict going on, you know. I've got Seventh Doctor bumping into the War Doctor.
I do have another cosplayer I spoke to, but I've kept her separate. And that's Elizabeth, a media student who had a rather striking and original take on the Fifth Doctor's costume. What she had to say about the Fifth Doctor was just as original and striking. Here's Elizabeth.
Okay, I've been joined by another absolutely fantastic cosplayer here. This is Elizabeth, and she has come as the Fifth Doctor. Why have you chosen to dress as the Fifth Doctor?
Mainly because I love the character. I love his personality, the way that Peter Davison sort of brought a more naive aspect to the character, whereas with other Doctors, they do care about the companions, but I love the way that Peter Davison shows his compassion towards his companions. He's more of a sort of fatherly figure towards Mr. and Adric, of course, after losing their parents.
Your costume is sensational. Now looking at it, have you made it yourself, or have you bought these bits? Where's it come from?
I bought the coat from a friend from a Doctor Who Facebook cosplay page. The jumper is actually a replica from the Doctor Who Experience. The shirt, I made it myself, sort of painting the insides as well. Had to stitch the question marks on it, which is a pin. The trousers are actually a pyjama bottom.
Right, okay, that's brilliant.
because my dad actually saw it and thought to himself, oh, that looks like Davison. So I was like, oh, yeah, so, you know, I thought I might as well do that. And the socks and shoes just from the shops, really.
It looks absolutely fantastic. Do you cosplay a lot?
Not as much as I'd like to, but this year I would have cosplayed Davison five times.
Right.
Because I'm going to Manchester Comic Con, and Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred are going to be there.
Okay, brilliant.
So I'm going to go there as well.
Okay, do you ever cosplay as anybody else?
I cosplayed Vanellope from Wreck-It Ralph.
Right.
And Castiel from CW Supernatural. But I've not really cosplayed anyone else. It's just trying to get the money together and sort of cosplay, really.
And have you had a fantastic time today?
I've had a really fantastic time. So yeah, it's just been brilliant.
Brilliant. Well, continue to have a good time, and thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Great. Thank you. No,
thank you.
I'd never really considered the Fifth Doctor's personality in that way. I guess because he was the Doctor when I was a child, and I just saw him as a hero rather than the emotional side, which of course we all know about now as the series moves on and it becomes more an important part. I thought Elizabeth's ideas were really fresh and different, and I hope you did too, because you will be hearing more from her on the podcast in the future. I'm going to play another soundbite from Elizabeth now.
Colin was brilliant, really funny. He just did a question and answers session, which of course I assume it'll be on the website later.
The question and answer session that will hopefully be online, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm playing it because at the time, and even when I spoke to Rob on the day of the con, I thought we might not have
a Colin Baker interview for you. I had issues with my recording equipment and my recordings really weren't usable. However, I was accompanied by Farin the Bath, who long-term listeners of me will have heard of. She recorded some bits which I've been able to use. You can actually hear Farin the Bath on this interview, as her daughter asks Colin a question, so see if you can spot her. I also wouldn't have been able to do it without a great recording from John Harrison. John writes a fantastic literature and book blog called Between the Blurb, which is at betweentheblurb.wordpress.com. Now, not only can you find a video of Colin being interviewed by me, but also a transcript of the comic book panel I hosted featuring friends of the show Rachel Smith and Lee Sullivan, as well as Lee Bradley, who is an accredited LucasArts artist. I don't currently have a recording of that panel, so John's blog is a great resource for you to go and have a look at that, as well as loads of other interesting articles that he's created. So please do go and have a look at that. So FIB and John's sections are linked with my recordings, so I do apologise for the sound quality, but they do fill in stuff I wouldn't want you to miss. The last person to thank is Colin Baker, who is a lovely man. My job was to be the connection between him and the audience on the day, but what you have to remember is that I'm a lifelong Doctor Who fan, same as the audience. It was really strange, and I would not have been able to do it if Colin hadn't been such good fun. As with many of our special guests, Colin asks that you take time to have a look at his chosen good cause and perhaps make a contribution. And Colin's charity is the Stoke & Church Dog Rescue. And that can be found at stokeandchurchdogrescue.org.uk. So without further ado, here is my Q&A session with Colin. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, how are we doing? I hope you're waiting for me, but if you're not, you'll be very disappointed. That's Andy. He's very handy, aren't you? Am I on my own, Andy?
No, I'm here.
You're the MC, are you, Andy?
Yeah, I'm the sick today, Bobby Perry. Very nice.
I think perhaps not. You've got a beard. Most sensible people don't have beards.
Well, I'm not sensible at all.
Until yesterday, I have one. Now. No. My wife kept saying, don't shave your beard off, because you'll have about six tubes under that lot. And when I've done it, she said, actually, no, you don't look too bad. Charming.
That's why I keep that. I don't know what it's underneath.
I've had it for getting on for 2.5 years. And I suddenly decided it's summer. The beardless look. There's a few beards here. When did you last shave yours off? Oh, that's a month's growth.
Ooh,
equal growth. It's very good. It's a diet, you know. That's what I drink.
I think we start.
I feel it here. I feel it here. I ought to be mixing the corpses. It's got a definite vibe, doesn't it? Well, then you're
well, in charge. Well, I'm sort of in charge. He doesn't need much of an introduction. It's Colin Baker, the Sixth Doctor from Doctor Who.
What do you do, Andy?
Well, I'm a bit of this, a bit of that, you know.
That's so
I podcast.
You do podcasts? Is that what you do 24 hours a day?
No.
Are you a computer programmer?
I'm not a computer programmer, no.
That's software, right?
No, not software, I guess.
Wow. So that's removed about 80% of these.
Immediately, if you'd like to know my day job, I teach 16 and 18 year olds how to be designers on computers.
Ah! CAD.
I can colour in as well.
You're a CAD.
I am a CAD.
I've been interviewed by a cat.
Absolutely.
An absolute cat. Sixth form college or
further education college?
Yes. Are you good at it?
I'm excellent at it. And,
is anybody in the room that is taught by him? That's
it. One of our parents is about someone.
Isn't that a shame?
She's dressed as a Pokemon.
Dressed as a Pokemon?
Yes.
May mean something to somebody else, it doesn't to me. This whole anime thing, I go to these conventions in the States, Comic Cons, and it seems like there's a lot of 8-year-old girls walking around with the most ridiculous costumes that all come from Japanese anime,
and 20-year-old men.
Is that you?
I'm starting to wish I wore my Sylvester McCoy jumper.
I'm very glad you didn't. Because you know he is the false doctor, don't you? McCoy.
He's the false doctor.
The false doctor. D- Did you see me regenerate? Therefore, I did not regenerate.
Ah.
Therefore, I am still the Doctor.
So none of the others count.
McCoy and onwards are all pretenders.
And that's the plot of the 60th anniversary special.
However, if you wait till September, when Big Finish...
Ah, well, you got the plug in early, didn't you?
Yeah!
I knew my start question, I knew my end one, I didn't know what to put in between, but we'll go straight to that then.
Yeah, yeah, I have reluctantly agreed to regenerate on audio.
That'll look fantastic.
It will, won't yes. So, as of September, I will legitimise McCoy.
And are you going to regenerate quietly, or are you going to go out with a bang? That's a silly question to ask you, isn't it?
I have to say, the reason that I agreed to do it was because the script was so good.
Mm.
And it fits in perfectly with everything we know leading up to that moment and after that moment. And it adds all sorts of extras to it. It's a very clever script. I'm trying to remember what it's called, and I can't.
I don't actually know what the title is, because it's just been promoted as The Sixth Doctor and the Last Adventure. Is what
maybe that's what it's called.
I don't know if that's what it's called.
And it kind of comes in several chunks.
Mm.
But I'm very pleased with it, so...
Well, that's very
enjoy,
good.
Enjoy. Go on, ask your questions then.
Well, that's one of them done, everybody, so thank you for that. Well, I was very interested, because in 2005, when Doctor Who came back, we had a gritty northern actor, quite moody with a cool coat. But it did make me think, in 84, we had a gritty, northern, moody actor with a cool coat, because, well, tell us about the way you played the Doctor.
Well, there are several things to talk about there.
Mm.
The first is, when I was asked to play the part in 1983, they said, what would you like to wear? And I said, do we have to have a costume? Can't I just wear clothes? You know, people did. In real life, who wears a costume? Or maybe a policeman or a... But why should the Doctor wear a costume? Don't they have a TARDIS washing machine? So why do you wear the same thing every damn day? Doesn't it get dirty and need a wash? Anyway, so I said, can't we... Of course, you know the reason why the Doctor has a costume. Because when their wardrobe department, they have to make one for the whole series. You know, you don't have to get a new... something new for them to wear.
Every year.
Well, every day.
Every day. Every day of every year. You want
if
to
you're in Corrie or something like that, you have a selection of clothes, and if the story goes from one day to the next, you have to mark that by giving them something different to wear to show time has passed. Well, time passing on the Doctor.
Mm.
It's much easier. Keep them in the same. It's so much cheaper. One costume. That's all they have to worry about. So... on that basis, I described what I would like to wear. And it's exactly what Christopher Eccleston got. A long black coat, I said. I thought, the Doctor doing what the Doctor does frequently and repeatedly means he might want to disappear into the background, you know, pass unnoticed as all the scary things go by. So something black would be good.
Yeah.
And what did they give me? The producer decreed I should be totally tasteless. And he got that right, didn't he?
He certainly did.
The only consolation was I was on the inside looking out. I didn't have to look at it. I do feel sorry for you lot. But there is an upside. All these years later, now the BBC has realised that Doctor Who is something worth doing and making, and they've got proper merchandise. All those little models, like the one you had sitting on my chair, which one do all the kids like best?
The colourful, bright, exciting one.
Colourful, bright, exciting one.
I dropped him
now. Now, what did you pay for that?
Well, and if I'm honest, I paid £1 at Wallen Street car boot sale. That would mean something to someone.
Oh, I love that. I love that look a bit. Well, for every one of those sold, I get 0.00000000000001 of a penny.
Wow.
So when they sell a million, I'll get a pound.
That's fantastic.
But it's more than the rest of them will get.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Once my doctor wins. So yes, Northern Doctors.
Yes.
I remember when Eccleston arrived and he said, it's about time we had a Northern Doctor. Passing over the fact, I come from Rochdale, Tom Baker came from Liverpool, Sylvester McCoy comes from Scotland, how northern can you get? So there's the immediate three were all northern, but Eccleston was more northern apparently, because he spoke like that.
Absolutely.
Which I wasn't allowed to do as a young actor.
Well, this interests me because I've always been fascinated that there are many actors in the world, in the country. It's a very select club, Doctor Who. There's not many of you. It always was, no matter how the programme was perceived by the public, it always was headline news when we got a new Doctor Who. How on earth do you get yourself in that process? How did it happen?
I know, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, my daughter said to me, hey, do you realise when you die, it'll be on the news? Thanks, lovely. That's a consolation, isn't it? Oh, never mind, I'll be on the news. So yeah, it is. It's how did I get into it? I was asked by John Nathan Turner to play it. I didn't have to do an audition. I didn't have to read. I didn't have to film one of those films you film when you go to do a film. Audition reel. I didn't have to do one of them. I played a part in a Peter Davison episode, Ark of Infinity. I played Maxell, who was a guard. Well, a glory, for he was head of the guard. And there was something in my performance that made John Nathan Turner, because in those days, now it's all film. So every day you turn up and you, from scratch, do a quick rehearsal and do that bit. Ditto, ditto, all the way along. In the old days, we used to rehearse it like a play. So you'd learn the whole thing, you'd do the whole thing, and run it through for the producer in a rehearsal studio. So he could see it from beginning to end, performed. And then you go to the studio and they film it out of sequence. So at the end of the producer's run, as they used to call it, he came over to me and said, what's this programme called? I said, Doctor Who, you idiot, don't know what his own programme's called. He said, oh, it's not called Maxill the Guard, then. I said, no. He said, well, you're playing it as if it is, as if you're the most important person there. What I was doing, whenever Peter Davison was talking, yawning, examining my fingernails, brushing my hair, upstaging him, basically. And I said, well, Maxwell is the most important person in his own life. He said, yes, but not in this programme. If you could let Peter have some of the screen, I'd be very grateful. So we laughed about it. And I did what he asked me to do. I toned it down a bit. But we hit it off. We laughed together about it. And then a few weeks later, Peter said he was leaving. So John says he thought immediately that I would be the person to take over, which is extraordinary. So I got the best part on television, given to me.
You did, and it's a job for life, isn't it, really?
It is. Here I am now.
Absolutely.
32 years later.
What's the difference? What's the difference now, then, between looking back and looking forward back then?
Oh, blimey. Well, the first thing they were at great pains to explain was that this is a programme that's going to be with me forever. They said, you do realise what you're letting yourself in for. And I did, I realised already, but they announced the fact that I was taking over and shoved me on a plane, flew me over to Miami. It's a tough life. To a convention where 10,000 people went ballistic that a new doctor had come to visit them. I didn't know at that point a single word of it because nobody had shown me a script. All I knew was I was playing the sixth doctor. And if a lot of people are that interested before you've been seen on screen, I knew what was going to happen. And even through the dark years from 89 till it came back in 2003, was it?
2005.
In those 6 years, you see, everything happens in sixes. The sixth Doctor, 6 years off the screen. And then six Doctors later, they get a northern one. Well, he's Scottish, that's northern, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
He's grumpy, he's awkward, he's a bit worrying. So they got that right, haven't they, again?
You were working there during the 80s, and you often hear stories about how you talked about rehearsals and run-throughs and things like that, but also it seemed to me there were a lot of constraints with unions and crews and different teams of people all having different rules about what time things should and shouldn't happen. Did that cause problems when filming?
Well, yeah, I mean, because you rehearsed it for a week, you did that right now I told you about, then you went into the studio and you had a day rehearsing again on set, and then you had usually 3 hours in the evening from 7 till 10 to film it, and that's not a lot of time even for a half hour programme. So by the time you got to 3 minutes to 10 and you only have one scene left to do, the trips were down. The pressure to not make a mistake was huge, and because at 10 o'clock either all the crew would be paid massive overtime, or if they chose to, they didn't even have to accept overtime and just pull the plugs, turn everything off. And the unions had a strong grip on television then. And I did do, there was one story I was doing with Brian Blessed. You know who Brian Blessed is, don't you? And we had one scene to do with Brian, myself and Nicola, who played Perry. And we had to run down a corridor, lots of explosions, open a door, run in, and Brian, we had to rescue Perry, get back out the door, and Brian had the line, "Right, let's find the mentors." And we did it, it all went round, the clock ticking towards 10, and he couldn't think of the word mentors. So instead of saying the word mentors, just think of the worst swear word you can think of and join two or three of them together. Right? He said, "Right, let's find the bleep, 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 bleep arons." And laughed like a madman. The clock hit 10 and all the lights went on and the cameras went off. Had that been me doing that, the producer, the director would have screamed at me because I'd wrecked the tape. It was a continuous following camera, and they'd take ages to set up. So they had to leave that set where it was instead of taking it down and building a new one for the next day. They had to leave it and film it again the next filming session. Nobody said a word to Brian, who was walking around laughing, saying, "Stupid, runny words. I can't remember a damn one of them. Who wrote this rubbish?" I would have possibly been sacked, I don't know. But there's something about Brian Blessed, you don't do that, because you might rip your head off and eat it.
I think I might be about to drop you in it here, Colin, because I'm going to take us down a track that means you're going to talk about Doctor Who fans. And there might be one or two in here.
No, that's all right, I'll talk to you.
Well, do you know what? The reason is, though, it's a good thing, really. But did you know where the City of Culture in a couple of years?
The City of Culture is Hull.
Hull is the City of Culture.
I'm up for that.
Fantastic. Well, one of the reasons I'm bringing it up is because I think that Doctor Who fans are quite cultured, because I've met you a couple of times before as a fan, and once was standing outside the stage door at a Hull New Theatre after seeing you in a Gilbert and Sullivan musical.
Hey!
Now, had you not been in that, I would never have gone to see a Gilbert and Sullivan musical. Yeah, I did. I just wondered what are the most obscure
events
and places.
Did you like it?
Oh, I had great fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the set design and everything like that, so there's lots of good things. But yeah, I did enjoy it. But we end up going to things like that and seeing plays, because a lot of...
I'll tell you a story. I did a play, I can't remember now what the play was, I really can't. It wasn't an obvious play for a Doctor Who fan or anybody else to go to much. And I was outside the stage door, and stage doors are always down dark alleys. And I was standing out I came out the door, and standing there was a really frightening looking figure, dressed in black leather, covered in tattoos, staring at me. And I said, "Hello." He said, "I've just been to see that." I said, "I've never been to a theatre before." He was Northern. I came to this theatre. Where was it? I think it was Leeds or... Sheffield. It was Sheffield. Outside the stage door in Sheffield. He said, "I've never been before." He said, "But I like Doctor Who, so I came to see you." I love it. "Oh, the theatre," he said, it's really happening right in front of you. And he looked terrible. If you met him in the street, you'd have thought he was going to knife you. But overnight, because he liked Doctor Who, he came to see, could have been any Doctor Who actor, it was me, in a play. And the next night, he came back with two of his biker buddies, all going, "You're right, it's fantastic." And he said, I found out what's on next week, I'm going to see it. If that's all it takes to get people into a theatre, how fantastic. And I was like, it was like I was walking on air going home that night, because these guys had, because of me, discovered something they would perhaps never have discovered before, like your passion for Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh yes, but everything bad in the scenes. We mentioned how you grabbed the headlines when you became Doctor Who, and how you'll grab them when you die, but Doctor Who grabbed headlines in your time, and of course we had what was known as the 18-month hiatus, was it known as?
Yeah, all that.
Well, it's quite interesting to think back to that now as well, because there's a lot of TV series, things like Sherlock, that often have gaps of 2 years or more between them.
Yeah.
At that time, 18 months seemed like it was headline news. This program won't be back on for over a year. It was absolutely obvious. What was that like at the time?
Well, it was weird, because I'd done my first season. I was already contracted to do the next season. And then Michael Grade came to the BBC, and he was on record, before he came to BBC, as not thinking Doctor Who was all that. I remember seeing him interviewed on London Weekend Television when he worked there, and they were talking about the BBC, and he was saying, "The BBC is just past its sell-by date. It's still churning out old rubbish like Come Dancing, Doctor Who," and he named a few programmes. So it was hardly surprising when he arrived, he decided he was going to axe it. What he wasn't prepared for, because he went on holiday immediately, axed Doctor Who, went on holiday, skiing down a slope in Switzerland, and having reporters either side of him on skis going, "Why have you axed Doctor Who?" And he suddenly had to justify it. So he said, "Oh, it's not axed, it's coming back, it's just having a rest. And so, "What do you think we should do to Dr. Who, Mr. Grade?" And, well, I hope there's no reporters here, because you don't all talk like that. But the red top ones do. And he said, it was getting too violent, and needs more comedy. So all John Nathan Turner was given was less violence, more comedy. And then it came back 18 months later. And during that 18 months, the script editor decided that he would do Trial of a Time Lord to reflect what was really happening. Not sure that was a terribly good idea, but that's what happened. But the management of the BBC did not like the programme much. And the BBC was set up differently then. Because any other business, if you make widgets and you sell more widgets than anything else, you keep making widgets. Financial common sense. But the BBC programme making department didn't get any money back from the programme it made. That went into the general BBC coffers and never got back to the programme. So there was no incentive for any producer to keep on producing something because it was financially successful. And most producers are quite creative people. They want to do new stuff. So programmes that are successful just used to fade away because they wanted to do something new. And that's kind of what happened to Doctor Who. It was unloved. I went to America to do a convention when I was doing the programme. and the head of a TV company over there came to the event because it sold hugely in America on PBS stations in the 80s, and said, "Hey, Colin, when you go back to England, can you go see Mike Braid and tell him we need more Who?" And the idea of me, an actor, going to see the head of the BBC and saying, "A man in America has told me to tell you he wants more Doctor Who," which is ridiculous. American actors in successful programmes do have that power. British ones don't. But I couldn't explain that to him, and he couldn't understand it. Why the BBC wasn't in love with its most successful product. Now it is, but it's all set up differently now. Now the budget comes partially from what the programme makes. And the budget they get now, Doctor Who, is even, you know, making allowances for 30 years' time difference, is hugely more. And the BBC likes it.
Yeah.
We had one Radio Times cover every 2 or 3 years in the old days. They do it every other week now. It's Doctor Who on the front page.
It costs a lot of money to keep up with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. One interesting thing is that these days, if something like that was to happen, there'd be a massive uproar and a Twitter campaign and a Facebook group.
Yes.
Now, what fascinates me is that there was a campaign of sorts back in those days, and you made a charity record, an all-star charity record.
No, I didn't. Some bloke who looked like me.
Was it?
Oh, that was ill-advised. That was so ill-advised. I was very reluctant to do it. Because, of course, you know, the bloke who's losing his job, because of course I'm going to want them. So I said, other people should do the protesting, not me. But I got the three-line whip from John Nathan Turner, who told me I had to come along and do it. And you did what the producer told you. But it was weird, because none of those singers, because there are quite a lot of well-known singers on that album. I haven't got a clue what they were there for. And were totally perplexed. The record producer was a mad Doctor Who fan, and he organised it all, but it was a silly idea.
But it goes for loads on eBay, I expect, now, doesn't it?
Well, I think people pay you to take it away.
Well, now, I'm going to be slightly rude to you because I just need to see how far in we are, so I have to look at my clock.
Am I boring you?
No, you're not boring at all. If you just either want to...
I think these people are entitled
if you want to
some
sing,
questions.
And that's why I'm checking the time, you see, just to make sure I went right, we're sorted.
5 o'clock
already? Just in time. I was going to get you to sing something from HMS Pinafore.
Dream On.
Or Doctor Who. Right. Has anybody got a question for Colin?
Thank you. My name's Jet. My question relates actually to some of Mr. McCoy's first season, because the first story of his first season was Time in the Rock, I believe. Now, if what I've read on various magazines is such as true, you were initially offered that story as your final story, but you turned it down, I believe. I was wondering first, what was it when they offered it to you? Did they tell you much about it? Did it change much? And secondly, do you regret turning it down?
No. I had a phone call from John Nathan Turner in September, August September, of 86, I think it was, saying, "I've got some good news and some bad news." I said, "Oh, what's the good news?" He said, "Doctor Who's coming back next year." Hooray! What's the bad news? I said, "I'm sure there was a better way of telling you this." And he said, "I've been told to get a new doctor." "What, you mean not me?" "Yeah. They want you to do the first story and then go after that first story." And I said, "When are you filming that?" "Next April." "So they wanted me to commit to 2 weeks' work next April." And I said, I don't blame you. John's on my side. He was very upset. So I made an appointment to see the man that Michael Braid had ordered to do this. I've forgotten his name, he'll come back to me. And I said, why are you sacking for going out sacking? And you think, oh, wonder. It's just that Michael Gray thinks that this is a time to refresh the program with a new doctor. So, well, say anything you like, you know, you're leaving for ill health, it's doing work. Said, well, you know, you've got other projects. So I said, no. I don't have other projects. Yeah, well, we can say that. I said, no. Who told the truth? I have been, people repeatedly have said to me since then, you should never tell the truth. You should never, because most of the other doctors left in the same way, but they were leaving to do other work and stuff. But they were already told to clear off. Peter went to his own board. And I said, no. And he said, well, you can come back then and do the... I said, no, I'll come back and do the full season. But I'm not committing myself to 2 weeks' work in nearly a year's time, when I might be doing something else. I'll do the whole of that season and go at the end of it, and then I'll have done 3 seasons, which is what you signed me up for in the first place. And they said, okay, we'll think about that. And I never heard another word. I discovered later that the first story written by Pip and Jane, because I knew Pip and Jane, they were friends, they'd written it with me in mind, so presumably they had to change it. To what extent, I don't know. And Sylvester floundering around in my coat with a silly wig on. But two things. One, if I had committed myself, I'd have missed out on a year's work on a play, which I got. I did a play called Corpse, which toured and went into the West End for a year. And you can't take that risk as an actor. Yeah, you can't stay available for one TV episode in a year's time, too much of a risk. So I made the right decision for my career. Also, I was irritated. I was sufficiently irritated not to want to make their lives easy by doing what they wanted. I was going to do it on my terms. And I've still not seen that first story, because at the time I didn't want to watch it. Because if Sylvester had been brilliant, that would have been annoying. And if Sylvester had been awful, that would have been even more annoying. So at least now I don't know. So I mean, one day I must watch it and see. But I mean, obviously, time heals everything.
Absolutely. And right, there's a Superman called Chloe down here who put the hand up, so I'm going to go to her next.
What was your favourite monster?
You are. Oh. Because your mum says you're a bit of a monster, are you?
No, she's very good most of the time.
No, she isn't. I've got a new rule. I'll break it for you. But I do have a new rule, which is I object to the F word, favourite. Because people say, who's your favourite doctor? And the doctor is the doctor. Mm. I don't mind people saying, the one that I like best was. But when you go, my second favourite, my third favourite, my fourth favourite... My listing in order. Doctor Who magazine does it all the time. Which of the 2,000 episodes did you hate the most? I think having a favourite is okay, but all this desire to separate and to make one better than another kind of annoys me. Usually because I come down the bottom, to be fair. But my favourite monster... it's not the Weeping Angels. It could be, but they're so easy. You know, they had an inferior doctor to deal with. Sadly. Who didn't know that all you... If ever you meet a Weeping Angel, all you have to do is do that. Just switch eyes and can't get you. It takes a superior doctor to know that.
Wow.
But otherwise, they would be scary, but... So, my favourite is probably the one... Now, what are they called? The ones who go...
Oh, the Slitheen.
The Slitheen. A doctor that farts.
You like that?
I think that's wonderfully naughty. I think that's a very naughty monster. And I think there's a few of them in here.
Good pay. Right, we've got another question. Right, right here. The fruit
set. Your name?
My name's Derek. In the 50th anniversary,
under the impression that none of the early doctors would have been able to make a doctor on the film. I just feel it was odd. I would never want to do a fellow actor out of a job. But, I mean, it was quite genuine that Peter and Sylvester and I, and Paul, when we were at conventions, a year ahead of all that intervening time, before the 50th, would tentatively say to each other, you heard anything about the 50th?
No.
You? No. As it got nearer and nearer, it became quite obvious to us that
classic doctors were not required on voyage for this particular one, and which is why we made five-ish doctors, which people have been kind enough to say they enjoyed, because it did do something. It gave the fans what we knew they rather wanted, to have a nod to all of us, when clearly the BBC didn't see the necessity. So when we watched it, and we were all watched it together on that night, that stupid party they put on television, all the companions sitting there, not knowing why they were there, being ignored. It was very badly done. We watched it, and there was Tom being the, what was he called? The curator. No, he wasn't the curator, it was Tom Baker, who played the fourth doctor, looking like the fourth doctor, and the dialogue was, well, it's not the fourth doctor, is it? Yes, it is. It was just, I thought it was uncomfortable. A little irritating that Tom had been singled out to be in it and the rest of us hadn't. But, you know, I should be used to that in my business, because the acting business is one big rejection all the time. But it was just odd. And it looked, the programme would have worked perfectly without that bit.
It didn't add anything to the story. And all it did was make people go, oh, Tom Baker, isn't that nice? And instantly, you're out of believing in something. If you're watching something, you're believing it, enjoying, the exciting things are happening. And suddenly go, oh, isn't that nice, such an act, isn't it? You're not involved anymore. And it chucked me into my living room, watching television, or into wherever I was watching television, instead of being in the story, which hopefully is what you are when you're watching any dramatic narrative. And I just thought it was ill-judged. Shame.
We've got time for one more question. We've got a charity question to end on a high note, so we could cheer Colin up.
I'm always cheerful.
Hey, we've got a question on HMS before. I'm doing it too much, but you've been there. We'll come to you first, sir.
Hello there, my name's Oliver.
Hello, Oliver.
Hello, Colin. In your first ever story, whose idea was it to make you strangle Perry and be generally unreasonably rude?
Not trying to be rude myself, I just really want to know who made you strangle your companion.
Well, the person who wrote the script, clearly. Basically, they had realised that when Peter took over from Tom, they decided that he should be wiped out by the process of regeneration. I mean, when you think of what regeneration is, it's going to have some kind of effect. And because Peter had been kind of made exhausted and useless by him, and had to be carried round by his companions for two or three episodes of his first story, they decided that rather than have the energy sucked out of the programme like that, they should kick some energy into it by having me manic as a result of regeneration. And it's not too dissimilar from how Peter Capaldi started. He was hyper and manic and not very friendly to his companion. So I think he was a brave move. The decision was clearly made between the producer, the director, the writer, and the script editor. I wasn't present at that point, so I don't know. But I thought it was quite brave, especially as that first story came immediately up. Usually, the series would end with a regeneration, and you'd wait months
to see the new doctor. In my case, it ended at the end of my first story. It was off screen for months before the new season came back. So the British public saw me being mad, strangling Perry for three episodes. Well, I didn't strangle for three episodes. because my brain had been scrambled by regenerating. And right at the end, there's a clue that I might be alright, because when I say, I am the doctor, whether you like it or not, in the smile of the room.
Well, I know I'm speaking on behalf of absolutely everybody in this room when we say thank you very, very much to Colin Baker for coming and joining us today.
I was in Glasgow when they were the City of Culture, and I spent some time in Liverpool when they were the City of Culture, and both of those cities came alive and ended up 10 times better than they'd been before. So you're in for a good time, because Hull is going to blossom, and I'm proud to have been here ahead of the game. Have a good time. Take care.
Thank you very much, Colin.
So there we have it. I had a sensational time at Hull Comic Con, and well done to Steve and everyone at District 14 Events for hosting an amazing event to 2,500 very chuffed fans. It was amazing to see the cosplayers of all ages. It was great to meet fellow fans. It was great to host the Q&As, to make new friends, and to spend time with old ones. I'll end on a little poignant sci-fi link to Hull. This is our very own sci-fi rock band, The Spiders from Mars, made famous as David Bowie's backing band from the early 1970s when he was known as Ziggy Stardust. And in this band you'll find Trevor Boulder, who's sadly no longer with us, playing bass. You'll hear the late, great Mick Ronson, the wonderful guitarist, both of whom came from Hull. And on drums there you've got Woody Woodmansey, who was born in East Yorkshire, but he's an honorary son of Hull. And they all straddled this amazing world between fantasy and reality, which is really what I was doing at Comic-Con. So until next time, thanks very much, and ta-ra.
Well, here we are at the end of the 36th Who Wars, folks. Who would have thought we'd make it? My thanks, as always, to the team members for giving us such great quality reviews and features for the show. All of these people do it voluntarily, folks. They are amazing. They don't ask for any money or anything like that. I mean, what money? There is no money. We don't even have advertising on our website because, truth be told, podcast hosting and website hosting and things like that, it doesn't actually cost as much as people would have you believe. But I think that's all I'll say about that. Moving on, I wanted to talk this week in my back page section about Star Wars and a topic which came up during the week on Twitter when I threw out the, well, I thought rather innocuous comment that, you know, it is possible to have too much of a good thing. It is possible to have too much Star Wars. And for some people, I may as well have, I don't know, hung a litter of kittens from a tree, set fire to an orphanage. Who knows? Something pretty damn terrible. Because some people came down on me like a ton of bricks. I don't think they really grasped what I was saying, and I think there was certainly some generational difference in some of the comments as well, because you get people who are used to watching, you know, 15 superhero movies every year or, you know, something along those lines, and they think you can have loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of everything, and it's just great because you watch these things and then there's a new thing to watch, and then you watch that and then there's a new thing to watch, and it's just how you watch things, you know, in this attention deficit disorder world we live in. You just consume, 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 and that's it. Well, it used to be different, and for me it was different. This is what I mean by a generational thing. When the original Star Wars films came out, there was a 3-year gap in between each one. And, you know, further to that, things weren't fully explained about them. You know, in A New Hope, they talk about the Clone Wars, never explained it. In other films, they talk about events that had happened or people or whatever, and it was never fully explained. These days, everything is explained. The man standing to the left of that guy in the background, he has a backstory, and you can go and buy a book that tells you all about his backstory. Some people find that fascinating, and I guess at one time I used to as well, but then I started to realize some of the magic of the original Star Wars films was that they came out sparingly, and that things were left unexplained. It left you with more to play with in your imagination, I felt. And I still feel that way, actually. But as I got talking with people, and particularly as I got talking with more sensible people, perhaps on Twitter, big shout out to Joaquin Slowly, who many of you might know from the Star Wars side of things out there on Twitter. Joaquin is a great guy. He and I had quite a sensible conversation about it all. And it really comes down to the fact that, yes, I remember this time when Star Wars was used more sparingly. Star Wars wasn't fully explained all the time. And I don't want Star Wars to go changing too much. And that doesn't mean I don't want films to come out and I don't want to see people enjoying themselves or anything of that nature. But I do think less is more sometimes when it comes to Star Wars, when it comes to anything, really. You know, when it comes to food, why not eat a slice of really, really great cake rather than a whole mediocre cake? Or whatever. You know, that's probably a very bad example, but you know what I mean. And 6 movies coming up within the next decade is enough for me. And I know there are people out there who would love to have a movie every 6 months and just go crazy and shout it from the rooftops and think that was just the most amazing thing in the world. But I think the quality would suffer, and I think the special nature of what makes Star Wars special would suffer. And even now, with those superhero movies I made fun of, you know, earlier in this editorial, even now, critics are getting quite dismissive of them because they are just so common. You know, they're 2 for a penny, or whatever the old expression is. They're just blink and another one's coming out. And again, some people like this, particularly when we look at the generations. Younger generations just think this is normal, just think it's the way to be. You just consume the movie and move on, knowing that in another few months there's another superhero movie. You consume that and you move on. And this way that I grew up, where a movie came out and it was very special because there hadn't been one for the past 3 years, and you watched it and you thought, wow, that was amazing. Now it could be another 3 years before I see this again, and now I've got 3 years to think about what just happened, and because things aren't fully explained, I'm going to start to really speculate. And, you know, all this wonderful creativity and imagination that used to stem from that, I think, is largely gone, particularly in this age of spoilers and this age of, you know, social media and so on. So as Joaquin and I were talking about in that sensible conversation, things are different. The world has changed. The world has moved on. You know, the way I'd like to see things done perhaps isn't the way things are done or will be done in the world of the future. But it's a shame in some ways. And I think if, you know, in another 6 months Disney comes out with, yes, you've got the next 3 episodes of Star Wars, and yes, you've got the 3 anthology films, and hey, we're also going to do another couple of films about this and this, and of course there's Rebels on TV, and oh look, we're going to finally do that live action TV series we've always been talking about, or that Lucasfilm had always been talking about. It will really be reaching saturation point, and I think not just for me, for the reasons I've mentioned, but for a lot of people, for the regular punter who goes along and enjoys a Star Wars movie and then walks out and can't even remember what half the characters were called. They make up the vast majority of the ticket-buying audience. If you just start pumping Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars at them, they're going to get sick of it. People, regular punters, used to get sick of it back in the days of the prequels, when there were years between each prequel. They were getting sick of it then, so there is the possibility that people will be turned off. In fact, I'm sure some people will be turned off by the current schedule. And if it's added to within the next decade, they're going to be really turned off. And is that a good thing? Well, at the end of the day, movie making is a business, and I know a lot of people don't really think about this and don't really see it that way, but it is dollars and cents, and Disney's made a big investment to buy the rights to make Star Wars and, you know, give George Lucas his $4 billion or whatever the amount was, they're going to want to recoup that money pretty damn quickly, and they will. They're going to make probably $1 billion off this first Star Wars film, you know, so there's a quarter of the investment coming straight back to them. But they want to recoup that money, and I understand all that, and I understand it's a business. But you can screw the pooch. You can kill the goose that laid the golden egg. You can do all these things by pumping out too much content. And again, I know there's these people out there on Twitter who say, no, no, that's just your opinion, and you're wrong, and, you know, all of this. Fine if you think that way. That's good for you. But it is true that the more you pump out of something, the less special it becomes, the more common it becomes. This is true of anything, not just Star Wars. And there is the potential to really ruin things if you oversaturate the market. And I hope that doesn't happen. At the moment, I don't think it will happen. I think 6 movies within the next decade, yeah, that's pretty good. It's up there, but it's manageable. And of course, we've got Rebels on TV, and all the new books coming out, and the comics, and so on. It's up there, but hey, it's Star Wars. It's always had a fairly big presence. But I'm just wary of what might get announced in the next 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, adding to this schedule. And it's what gets added to this schedule that could really start to, you know, maybe just push the boat out a little too far. I don't know. What do you think? Why not write in and let me know? You can email me at hello@whowars.net, or even record yourself as an MP3 file and send it to the same address. I would love to hear from you. Now, before we go for this week, I did record an even longer introduction to this episode where I took an email from our regular listener, Baz Hood. Hello, Baz. And I read it out and I was commenting on it in the introduction. And then when I listened back to it, I thought, oh, this has been a really, really long introduction. It was nudging 20 minutes. And so I've chopped that bit out of the introduction. In fact, keener ears might even hear the point at which it was chopped out. I hope some of you don't, but I'm sure some of you will. And I've taken the audio and I'll play it here. This is an email from Baz Hood. He talks about a blog I've written on the Who Wars website. But of course, I'm about to explain all of that, so let me just hit play on the tape now, and I'll be back with you in just a moment. Let's move on, and before we move on to the show proper, let's have an email from Baz Hood. Hello, Baz, if you're listening, I'm sure you are. Baz has written an email based on something I wrote on the Who Wars blog. Now, if you go to whowars.net, you'll notice we have a blog where a lot of the entries relate to shows, like, you know, Who Wars episodes and Cloud City Council episodes and so on. But recently I wrote a blog based on the Old Republic video game and my experiences of following it for years before it came out and creating a guild and then getting into the game. And then the game massively disappointing all of us to the point where within a few months most people had left and the guild fell apart. So yeah, it's not a very happy story, but I guess there is a light at the end of the tunnel, which, if you read it towards the end, I talk about how I've recently been getting back into playing The Old Republic, now that it's a free-to-play game, and my experiences in it, and, you know, the good and the bad that I'm finding. So, without any further ado, if you're interested in all that, go to whowars.net and read it. And this is Baz's email reaction to what I said, and I'll throw in some thoughts and comments as I read this. That was a cool little article on the Old Republic game. I only started playing the game about 4 months ago, and I'm afraid I've already given up on it. Initially, it was an invigorating and neat little build-your-character-doing-quests-in-a-Star-Wars-setting game, but I've just found it so repetitive. It's such a shame, because the worlds they've built are really excellent with faithful characters and factions, planets, and tech. However, basically travelling from point A to point B, slaughtering everything in your path to click on a blue box representing a bomb, a file, a med pack, a tool, a foodstuff, or supply, and then travelling all the way back to point A to be told to travel even further to point C to click on more blue whatevers became so bloody tedious I haven't played it now for 5 or 6 weeks. I also had the moral question while playing as a Jedi Knight, would a Jedi really be murdering all these foes during these quests to help people? I suppose the longevity of the game is slightly helped by the somewhat clunky space battles, of which I did one and found it mildly entertaining, and the stronghold feature, which actually baffled me as to its point. It's a home for you to decorate, right, and build bits and bobs eventually through a pretty convoluted menu system that I couldn't be asked to navigate. Weirdness, but probably more to do with my attention span than any fault of the game. I've never really played an MMORPG since dabbling in Phantasy Star Online on the Dreamcast yonks ago. Anyway, I'll stop Baz's email here and I'll just jump in and say, yes, a lot of what we see in Star Wars The Old Republic is this sort of travel from point A to point B stuff. And I covered it in the blog to some degree when I was talking about how in the years leading up to Star Wars The Old Republic, we in the community were saying, don't make World of Warcraft in space. Don't make World of Warcraft in space. No, no, BioWare. Don't make World of Warcraft in space. And then what did they do? Well, as they got closer to releasing Star Wars The Old Republic, they started talking about, and by they I mean the developers, they started talking about how World of Warcraft really was the AAA standard in MMORPGs out there, and that started us thinking, oh no, they have made World of Warcraft in space, please help us. And I could go on and on about how World of Warcraft absolutely ruined the concept of MMORPGs, but this podcast would not be long enough. I'd run out of memory on my computer if I had to talk about that. So yeah, there is a simplicity to Star Wars The Old Republic that is annoying. When you're talking about traveling all the way back to point A, Baz, you may have missed that you can use quick travel to travel from point to point once you've unlocked certain areas, so you don't always have to run back on foot or take a speeder or whatever. It can be sped up in some ways, but yes, there is tedium definitely in the style of quests or missions that you're doing in that game. I completely agree. And also, to some degree, you mentioned, I think, you're playing a Jedi Knight. It can vary, too, on the classes you're playing. The stories based around the classes in that game are not all created equal. In fact, I would say something like the Imperial Agent storyline is miles and miles and miles more interesting than other stories in the game. I played a Bounty Hunter through to the level cap originally, and I thought it was okay, but in comparison to other stories in the game, it was pretty naff, and the Jedi storylines aren't particularly great either. So there is variation even amongst what classes you choose. Anyway, moving back to Baz's email, can't they program some timed trial quests or vehicle races or actual puzzles or stealth sections or spy missions or unlimited rice pudding, etc., etc.? Nice remembrance of the Daleks reference there, Baz. And yeah, look, you'd think those things would be pretty simple, and indeed, in Guild Wars 2, which is another MMORPG out there on the market, there are such things. I mean, they do have the sort of traditional quests that you're not a fan of, but they do also have puzzles and what they call jumping quests, where you've got to sort of jump your character up around a building or some sort of structure, and it takes a lot of skill and a lot of tries to get it right. So there are games out there that do it. So yes, technically Star Wars The Old Republic could do that. Whether they will or not, I don't know. I think their focus is really, particularly as we look at the new expansion pack that's coming out in a few months, they're trying to get back to that. Well, what they say get back to is what they should never have left, and that's the BioWare, you know, storytelling mechanisms where, you know, there's a really great story at hand and you have lots of choices. That's really where their mind is at with that game, I think, and then what your character actually does in terms of the quests or missions is a bit of an add-on. If you do like puzzle-type stuff, you might like Guild Wars 2. Depends whether you like a medieval sort of fantasy game, though. So, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, to finish up, he says, interestingly, the guild which asked me to be part of it is the Knights of Cydonia. Now, I mentioned that I had built a joke guild in SOTOR, or Star Wars The Old Republic, called the Knights of Cydonia, after the Muse song. But that wasn't us, Baz, asking you to join, because currently the only members of Knights of Cydonia are my wife and myself. So that wasn't us. And he said he doesn't know what it meant or what to do, so he hasn't interacted with anyone on there. And, you know, can I just say, that's probably a shame. One of the great things about MMORPGs is interacting with people and doing the quest together with them. So even if it is a fairly basic quest to, you know, go across the map and shoot up a bunch of bad guys and then come back for a reward, that is boring, once you do it, you know, a dozen times or two dozen times especially. But when you do it with a mate or two or three people and you're chatting, you know, over voice comms, maybe talking about the weather and, you know, all sorts of things not to do with the game, you can actually have quite a fun social experience with people and sort of get your little rewards in game as well. So that might help you. I don't know whether you want to go back to Star Wars The Old Republic, but that could be something. And he says, to finish up, I think I got myself to level 30-ish or so and had got myself a basic speeder, but that still didn't alleviate the boredom of the huge journeys required to navigate the various planets. One day, I might go back. Yes, I might, but until then... dot, dot, dot. Well, thank you, Baz, for writing. And again, there are quick ways to get around planets using the quick travel. It's a skill on your toolbar if you go back into the game. That may help the problem, because I know the maps are big. They're not as big as in Star Wars Galaxies, which was the original Star Wars MMORPG. The planets in that game were absolutely huge, and we didn't even have vehicles in that game initially. Everything was done on foot, and there wasn't quick travel. So, you know, you kids today with your Star Wars The Old Republic, you've got it easy compared to Star Wars Galaxies. But that's a whole other story. And in fact, I might actually write a blog entry on Star Wars Galaxies, because I have quite an extensive story to tell there too. All right, so that was me talking about an email from Baz Hood, of course. And I hope you enjoyed it, particularly if you've read the blog in question about Star Wars The Old Republic, the MMORPG I was writing about there. And maybe Baz's issues with the game are similar to your own. Again, just like my comments on Star Wars saturation, if you have any thoughts on Star Wars The Old Republic, why not write in and let me know to hello@whowars.net or send an MP3 to the same address and we'll use it on the show. Okay, I think that really is it for this episode. It's been, gosh, there's been so much great stuff in it. Matt and Elaine, I loved your review. Andy, excellent work at, you know, Hull Comic Con. Just amazing that we've got a Doctor from the classic era of Doctor Who now on the Who Wars interview list. If any of you want to see that list, go to whowars.net/interviews and you can see all the people we've interviewed on the show before. Just incredible. Just incredible. I'm so lucky to be producing this show. I thank all the team members for making it, and I thank all of you out there for listening to it and for talking to us on social media and whatnot. It really does make it all worthwhile. And with that, we'll see you in a couple of weeks in episode 37. Of course, next Sunday, there's Cloud City Council talking exclusively about Star Wars, particularly Star Wars comics. And if you didn't hear the last Cloud City Council, where our regulars sat down with Mike Climo and also Alan Zorg, who does contribute the Star Wars Rebels reviews to Who Wars, get in there and listen to that. There was an excellent conversation about Star Wars prequels coming from four guys who, get this, like the Star Wars prequels. If that's different to your worldview, I think you might really like to get in there and perhaps hear why these guys like it. They might even change your ideas on the prequels, or at least elements of the prequels. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. All right, folks, I'm rambling now, and I'll get out of your ears. So stay tuned for episode 37 in 2 weeks. Until then, tune in to Twitter @WhoWars and chat to me and all the team. We'd love to hear from you. Peace out. Ugh, did I really just say that?
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.